As events go, trail ultramarathons are far from easy to orchestrate. The many variables and interesting problems that are needed to be solved to pull together a safe and enjoyable trail race take a tremendous amount of inspiration, passion, work, sacrifice, and commitment for all involved, from runner to race director. One of the unfortunate circumstances that a runner may come across is that of a canceled race. Wild places bring serious and rapidly changing weather that include electrical storms, flash floods, avalanche, wildfire, and more that elevate the seriousness around the risk being taken by participants. With all of the work and passion a race director puts into each event, the very last thing they want to do is cancel a race. But sometimes it must be done. E-Clean Run Dirty wanted to learn more about these canceled races, what best practices there might be, and hear from runners and race directors that have been impacted by them. E-Clean Run Dirty writer and field reporter Chad Sullivan interviewed race directors and runners from all corners of the United States and Canada for a very special investigative article featured in issue 5 of E-Clean Run Dirty magazine. And I love this article. It kicks ass. In today's podcast, I read that article to provide an interactive audio version of that piece. I am joined for discussion with the author, Chad, and with Lee Connor, a friend of the show, my personal very good friend, and a trail runner that was interviewed for this article titled Rana Del Sims, Safe Racing, Doing the Right Thing, and Being Willing to Walk Away. My name is Jessica Vandenbush, and I am the host of the E-Clean Run Dirty podcast. This show is produced by Jay Prophet and listened to by you. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy the show. I would love to hear your feedback on this interesting, different sort of format that we did for this piece. And thank you for listening. Enjoy.
There must be an on button somewhere. Press the Apple thing.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Things are going to start happening to me now.
So I'm excited. I thought a really good format for this conversation would be for me to like read a paragraph of the article and then we can discuss it. So it's kind of like an audio version of the article.
Sure.
And then we'll put it out ahead of everybody getting the issue of the magazine in the mail. And so I think it's really exciting. Plus, I think it's an exciting article. And I love this. So let's preface this with Chad wrote a beautiful race report in the very late spring issue of Eat Clean Run Dirty magazine. Chad, do you remember what race that was for?
Yeah, it was for the Pottawatomie Trail Runs in Pekin, Illinois.
It was wonderful. That race looked like a total shit show, but your report of it was quite fantastic because it made me really feel like I knew what it felt like to be at that race that day. You know, it wasn't about what you had for breakfast. It was about the experience, which was fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah. And I appreciate you saying that. You know, and the race, it was a shit show. At least it's a 4-day event. And on Friday when I ran Friday when I ran the 50 mile was the only day of the 4 days that it did not just dunk rain endlessly.
Oh yeah, Nettie did the 200. I had pictures of her in
like
full rain gear.
She did. She said, I mean, she did an amazing job too. I think I even mentioned her in the piece.
Yeah, she's pretty stubborn. She did
I
not
wanna
quit.
Say she might have been the second woman to finish the 200 there. So she did something remarkable offhand. Yeah. I can't remember. But
that sounds right.
But
Nettie
yeah,
is always
just
doing something remarkable.
See, and this was the first time I had encountered her. And
she has willpower.
She must, because that's not an easy course. And especially when it's wet, it's a much more difficult course. And so for her to do what she did is remarkable. It was just, like you said, it was a shit show. It was just wet and slippery and all of those things.
I got to message her. Swiss Peaks registration open. I have to message her and harass her. I'm full of good ideas. I share them.
Hey, yeah, by all means.
So like 220 miles.
Oh, it looks horrifying.
What? It's 220 miles, but they give you like forever. But it's only got 87,000 feet of climb, so you don't have to run at all. You just have to
go hiking. It's just easy, like, yeah.
Yes.
apparently hold on to the side of the mountain and hope. Oh. So fun. Oh, my
God. That's wonderful. So I love Chad's race report so much. I reached out to him to write an article for the next issue, only this time I asked him if he would take an assignment. And I threw a couple of ideas at him. And one of the ideas was to do a story about canceled races. And I gave him a bunch of people to talk to. And one of those people was you, Lee Connor.
Mm-hmm. I remember. And I talked to him.
Yes.
So I think, and maybe Chad, you can explain this a little bit more just to set the table, I guess, for the story. But I think you had a certain idea of what the story was going to be about. And then you talked to Lee and everything changed.
It did. So I initially was reaching out to race directors when I was researching this story. I was reaching out to five or six different race directors and just looking for their take on not only what goes into a race, but just what goes into canceling a race. And I found while I was researching the topic that I needed perspective from the other side. I needed to hear from runners who had events canceled on them. And I spoke with a couple of runners, and it wasn't until I spoke with Lee that I actually discovered the through line for the story. I had a lot of disparate ideas, a lot of things I wanted to discuss. I didn't have a single thread to connect them to. And once I spoke with Lee and she recounted this story that I write about, I knew immediately that was the through line. That was the perfect entryway and exit, actually, from the story. And I think I even told that to her when we were having a conversation before we got off the phone. I said, I think I'm going to make this the focal point of the story. I hope you don't mind. So that's kind of how our involvement in this began.
I remember when Lee was at this race, she messaged me. I don't know if it was, it could have been when she was in this hut. Maybe it was after she got back to safety. But she was like, I was in this cabin with like 40 people and I was the only person who spoke English and the only woman.
Fluently. Yeah. there were a couple of people with some very stilted, but yeah, nobody really did.
So here we go. I'm going to read the first paragraph and then you guys like after tell me more about it as I am the reader and you fill me in. Ronna Del Sims, 100K, 2018. The storm rolled in across the Pyrenees near dusk, as unassuming as mist off a cooling autumn lake. Just a little rain, not uncommon to the unforgiving granite peaks towering awesomely over the verdant Andorian countryside, but unexpected all the same. Lee Connor was tending her feet in an aid station tent, set up just downhill from a small remote hostel nestled high up against the imposing cliffs. A stopover for backpackers. The hostel's lone point of access was a narrow trail, barely accessible by motorbike. There are no roads nearby. Supplies often had to be portered in on foot. Not that the hostel needed much to sustain its guests. It was a small place, barely large enough to house 20 travelers. Drying her feet, Lee remained steadfast against what lay ahead. She had been on the move since 10 p.m. the previous evening, running what she could and, when necessary, clambering hand over hand on fixed chains attached to steep, otherwise insurmountable slopes. She had miles yet to go. She was tired, Yet even as the Catalan spoken amongst volunteers began to grow more serious, her attention never wavered from Ridge beyond the hostel. Lee had a race to finish. So Rana Del Sims, Lee, where is this race?
In Andorra, which is in the Pyrenees between France and Spain.
What caused you to sign up for this race?
I heard about it and it said that it was a 48-hour cutoff for 100K. And I thought that's either hella generous or it's a sign that it's probably hella horrible. And I posted something and somebody else I know from running other things, I think that I must have met at UTMB or somewhere, was like, oh yeah, that's horrific. You're going to need that 48 hours. It has as much climb as Hard Rock, but in 110 kilometers, maybe 109. That's actually significant. And that means that the steepness is going to be very real. But also, in fairness, I did not stay in the med tent to dry my feet. I went up on the wood deck of the backpacker hut and made friends with some Catalan backpacker ladies. One of them spoke kind of English. One of them spoke Catalan, but I can understand her. And one of them spoke mostly French, but I can understand French, but I can't, but the Catalan can understand me. So like it was funny because so we all could understand each other somehow. And they gave me beer while I was dry because I showed them my feet. I'm like, they just have to dry. They'll be fine. And they're like, wait, you're doing what race? And so I explained the race to them and they gave me a beer. So
how'd they get beer up there?
The backpacker hut has beer. That's how I know they porter in. And I think they actually motorbike in or ATV or something supplies because they had beer at the backpacker hut. Not a lot of it, but they had some for sale. They have it at the hut. It's crazy. When you go up in the Alps and the Pyrenees, The little backpacker huts that look like they're primitive, they will actually have, they'll have spring water and stuff, but they'll have actually beer and wine.
Oh, that's fantastic.
A cheese tray. Yeah.
They charcuterie.
The things that they consider, they don't have anything like bad or fried food. But yeah, they'll have that up there on top of running water. They just, I guess that's a thing you need mid-trip. I don't think this one had wine. They just had one. They had two beer choices or maybe only one, but they had a choice. You could have juice or beer or water. And then we only had water. But so the nice backpacker ladies did give me a beer.
Could it be argued that Ronda Del Sims is one of the more difficult trail races in the world?
Yes, but actually it got canceled during pandemic when they had to cancel. The race directors received threats on their lives, apparently. I was still on their email because I wanted to go back, and they shut down the race. So supposedly it's coming back. There's a UTMB Andorra race, but it's not quite the same. Yeah. And it may come back all the way. It may not. They were very, very shaken because people filed lawsuits like right in the first few months of pandemic because it's an early summer race. So they were one of the first races to be forced to cancel because of pandemic.
And well, I would imagine. Saying,
people have threatened our lives over this. Oh. It's not worth it to us. And we're bankrupt on top of that because of the amount of money we lost because we can't put on the race. So we can't. Because they were pretty destroyed and just were like, we're not doing this.
Well, and being an island nation like that.
They said, they're tiny. They have their own bank in Andorra, but they're just this. They're like the size of Greater Cleveland, maybe smaller, up in the Pyrenees.
Well, I would see there's like five major towns. Cause for concern with the pandemic and having all of these people coming from all over the world to their island when there's a...
Not island, they're in the mountains.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't... You can drive up from either Barcelona or Toulouse in France.
Okay.
The road's going up, but there's only a couple roads in, and then they've got their own little ring of towns. They're just way the heck up in the mountains. But it is a pretty cool area, and Catalan overlaps. But yeah, so they have canceled, but I would say that is definitely one of the more challenging because their 100 mile is like 60 hour cutoff and something like 44,000 feet of gain or something. That's just ridiculous. But there's a handful of other races. Like there's Ultra Tour Monte Rosa and there's the Fool's Diagonal over in Reunion Island. Those are other horrible races. So there's a handful of other races that are horrible, but I haven't done them for comparison. They're on my list. I'll get back to you when I have completed these other plans.
Wonderful. All right. And it continues. I was just about to leave, said Lee. It was suggested I let the storm blow over. It will be gone in 20 minutes. 20 minutes later, it was hailing. 20 minutes after that, it was big hail. By the time it was dark, they wouldn't let anyone leave the checkpoint. As the storm intensified, the air turned frigid. With darkness blanketing the Pyrenees, temperature hovered below freezing, a precipitous decline from the mild temperatures recorded only hours earlier. With conditions continuing to worsen, the situation on the mountain was rapidly growing dire. At what point in the race was this, Lee? About what mile or?
Around, I mean, it was near halfway. I don't remember exactly. I could probably find it. I'd probably recognize it on a map, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I could picture it. I could certainly recognize it if I saw it again and picture that. But it's funny how a thing will get frozen in your mind like that. But it was around the halfway point.
Was there any talk of how the weather might be, any kind of weather might be coming in before the race? Mm-hmm. Did they have any idea?
This was very unexpected. This storm, I found out later, the New York Times covered this storm. It shut down the entire country of Andorra and any traffic in and out of the Pyrenees. Like, all the roads were closed. Everything was shut down. The whole, nothing hits like that. So they had 100%, like, in the overnight and during most of the, in the next day, some of the roads were open and some weren't. Like, everything. They do have some equipment to clear snow for winter, but it wasn't winter. It was summer.
Yeah.
And they get, but it never storms like that. This was a standout storm. Like, nothing had happened in the previous 30 years. There was nothing warning them it would be more than just another flashover storm. Just one of those random change things that can happen. So they just did not know until it was there. There was absolutely no warning. We all had mandatory kit because it's the mountains. So everyone had to have a full seam sealed hooded rain jacket and rain pants, long pants, a medium weight base layer, a Mylar blanket, a hat, gloves, full I'm running in the European mountains kit that they require for absolutely everything. And there'd been gear checks. So everyone had it.
Yeah.
Because they did kit check morning up, like, because an evening race, they're kit checking you within an hour or two of starting. Like, you'd have to go through kit check, get your bib, be funneled into the starting area, and then leave and drop stuff to get rid of your stuff.
Which right.
No one would do because it's being required for a reason. And so, yeah, people had stuff.
That's good.
But this, like, when it goes from, you know, 60 and you're in your t-shirt and capris or tights, but your tights are feeling warm, and then all of a sudden, like, really within maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, it was 25 degrees and frozen and falling, and everything got wet before it got cold. So if you were out there, everything got windy and soaked. So you've now become completely soaked, and now it's 25 degrees and high winds with hail hitting you. So some of the people who had their kit didn't even think to put it on until they were already too cold.
Yeah,
I happily got stuck in a spot. Like, I saw it coming in. I was like, I was going to leave. I was like, oh, there's weather coming in. I'm leaving before the weather hits here. And they're like, no. The first drops hit, and they're like, no, you stay. I was like, oh.
It was too fast.
And no one had left within the half hour before me. Like the next, like when I came in, a couple people were leaving, and then a couple people came in with me and we were still there. And they're like, no, you guys stay here. You stay here. I'm like, ah, come on. They're like, just 20 minutes. You stay here. Eat something.
Right.
And you're like, okay, well, if it took this long to get here, I'm probably going to be on this course another 20 hours. Yeah. Okay. I'll have a snack.
Right. Here, Chad writes on, race stories are, in essence, survival stories, war stories for ultra runners. There are stories peppered with absurdity, near misses, and suffering. There are stories recounted from the other side, shared over a beer, dry and comfortable, to the cadence of a calm pulse, away from the churning chaos of the moment. They aren't always easy stories. Sometimes people get hurt. But the good stories, the best stories, offer beauty and light, a way in to our wild, pounding hearts. Yet sometimes a race story is not a race story at all, but a cancellation story, a near miss of a different kind, no less a story of survival, as why else shutter an event if not for preserving the safety of those involved, but a story spun on a different arc, one based in hypotheticals and approximations. In a cancellation story, the stakes are heightened, the absurdism skews dark, bridges wash out, trees fall in bunkhouses, a pandemic rages. In those stories, races aren't run. They play out in our heads. No one gets hurt. And then there are the cancellation stories that aren't near misses. They are the ugly stories of desperation and catastrophe, when things got sloppy and races were canceled too late, if at all. Stories that gut the ultra community and expose it to scrutiny from a world that doesn't understand it. These are stories that move slowly, building up over years and years, patiently gathering steam while no one is looking, and then exploding like a storm in the mountains. in those stories, people die. When we're evaluating the course, evaluating the runner's ability to safely navigate and not put themselves in imminent danger, it made the decision pretty easy, said Dale Garland, race director of the Hard Rock 100. It was easy, but it was hard, if that makes any sense. Dale's recounting his decision to cancel Hard Rock in 2019. The San Juan Mountains had experienced historic snowfall over the winter. Avalanche debris from the subsequent runoff lay strewn across portions of the trail, and the potential for an avalanche to occur during the race created a variable he wasn't comfortable risking. Course alternatives were considered. A point-to-point was even bandied about. But in the end, changing Hard Rock simply didn't feel right. How do I put this? Said Dale, mulling over his words carefully. People come to Hard Rock expecting a certain level of challenge. We could never replicate that challenge. So thinking of that, like, you know, Chad, tell me more about your conversation with Dale.
So it was a short conversation with Dale, but he was very gracious nonetheless. And we were discussing, obviously, what happened in 2019, specifically because it had to do with a cancellation that wasn't COVID related. And I was curious about how races were reacting to situations, particularly out west, with the wildfires, with some of the freak storms that are going through the mountains, with, you know, what happened in Utah recently. And I was just curious to see how race directors were going about that situation, you know, prior to this blanket cancellation that we had seen over the last couple of years. He was pretty direct in the sense that Hard Rock is what it is, and it's not a race that is easy to change because there are so many expectations from the runners who sign up to participate, from those who put their names in the lotteries, from those who line up the day of. They expect Hard Rock, and they, you know, to change the course to alter some of the rules. I mean, these things are really highly scrutinized by Dale and, you know, those on his team. And I found this fascinating because it was an aspect of, you know, race directing that was a little bit more hardline than other race directors I had talked to. Not that Dale or his team are averse to change, but just that they're very aware of what they have, what they possess, what it is that they're kind of guarding in a sense. And so, you know, his responsibility to that is pretty great.
These decisions, there's so many different factors coming into it, and it's got to be, you know, like Hard Rock, like, exactly, that's a great point. A race like that, people are in the lottery for years and years, and all the care that goes into it.
They rolled them over.
They don't. Oh, exactly. But I mean, they didn't sign up for like the road version, you know, like, oh, yeah. They didn't.
Oh, I'm
sign
glad
up
they didn't run a road version.
Right.
Well, that doesn't even count.
And so,
I'm glad
talking
they
about,
that.
You know, especially with changing the course. One thing I don't mention in the article, and something that I actually did talk, you know, at length with Heather McDonald, who will be mentioned in the article here soon. She's the race director for Fat Dog 120. And
I have my rollover from that cancellation for the last
really?
Year.
Well, yeah, she was saying that they've gone so far as to just create three alternate courses. So they're doing preemptively, she's doing whatever she can to, to basically, you know, align themselves for success moving forward, so that if one portion of the trail is on fire, they'll just, you know,
they have a reroute plan already.
But because exactly. of her, I got to stay fit. I don't know what I like. I keep getting it deferred. So now I got to just like constantly stay in Fat Dog 120 shape. It's her fault I'm staying in shape. See that?
It is her fault.
Yeah, I got to stay fit.
Hey, there you go.
Here, I'll continue. He isn't wrong about that. Hard Rock is notoriously difficult. Its status among runners legendary. Tinkering with the course is playing with fire. He risks altering the race's near mythical allure, diluting a legacy he's carefully nurtured and guarded since 1992. The best runners in the world line up to race Hard Rock, not a cobbled together variation on Hard Rock. It is something we deal with every year, said Dale, in reference to weather variables. Any prudent race director should plan on evaluating that on a yearly basis. Heather McDonald is no stranger to evaluating the weather. As race director for the Fat Dog 120, which hopefully Lee and I will both be at this August, Heather has had to cancel the event four times since its inception in 2010, twice over weather-related concerns. In 2011, I had to cancel because of the snow. Heather said, seriously, the snow was so high, we couldn't have cleared it off the trail if we had wanted to. So we moved the race from July to August. But what August brings is wildfire. In 2018, wildfires shut down the race 2 days before it was set to go off. We've had to be pretty flexible, Heather said. Put plainly, race directors aren't looking to cancel an event. That may come across as obvious, but it bears stating. Reading through Heather's monthly preparation checklist for Fat Dog is dizzying. No one puts in this amount of work without the expectation to see it through. As one race ends, preparations are already being made for the following year. In June alone, for example, Heather has had 19 separate tasks to juggle. She has had to update Fat Dog's emergency response plan, confirm their insurance certification, print posters, review the communication plan, and finalize the belt buckle and t-shirt orders, among a slew of other things. And yet, despite all that work, all the hours spent filling out paperwork, clearing trails, coordinating volunteers, and composing emails, Heather knows nothing is guaranteed. She has to be willing to walk away.
Glad I'm not the RD.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I was
talking. Everyone's mad at the RDs, but they put way more into the RD stuff than I have to put into preparing for a race.
Oh, right. Right. And I think that's why, you know, Chad, your statement in there saying the RD does not want to cancel this race. I think sometimes people forget about that and forget about just how much work and preparation people put into these, especially these rugged, hard mountain races in these remote areas and all the work that does go into making them happen.
Yeah. And I completely agree. And I was, when I first started looking into this topic, I was just looking at message boards. I was curious to see what people were saying about events that had been canceled. And the majority of it is actually very positive. I mean, the ultra running community typically seems to be very understanding of these things, and they don't really push back too hard when something like this occurs. There are outliers. There are those who do... do bring up, grudges or not grudges, but they do, they do bring up, beefs, and they do have to take issue with certain aspects of races being canceled. And I don't see it as often. I didn't see it as often. And I was encouraged by that. And that made the interview process whereby I was actually receiving some of these plans, like Heather's, for example, it illuminated, not only what the race directors go through, but the duration for how long they go through it. I mean, they'll be doing this from the day that one race ends all the way through to the morning of the start for, a following year's event. And it's an endless cycle for race directors to prepare and to make sure that all of their ducks are in a row, because there's a lot of riding on the decisions that they're making. And so it's encouraging to me that when a race is canceled, the people who are taking to social media and are, responding to the news, for the most part, they're pretty kind and optimistic and generous. That makes it, I think, easier, at least from my perspective, just looking at the community as a whole, to just step back and hear the criticism of those who do present it as also, being valid, but not quite as loud.
I know the last race that I've, you know, been signed up for that has been canceled was Pine to Palm this last fall. And the reaction to everybody, I feel like maybe it was canceled 2 weeks before. The reaction was immediately, how can we help? You know, knowing that it's a tough decision, but knowing all the resources that that race director puts into it and knowing what it means to that community there too, to have all these people come in for the race. You know, it has such a ripple effect, and the response, and that, I don't know if I said, but that race was canceled due to wildfire, but the response was, let us know where you need us, or, you know, what can we do to help? Overwhelmingly positive and supportive from the runners. There weren't people who, you know, were, oh, I'm going to go run it on my own anyway. Or, cause that's the other side of it too, is, you know, sometimes the runners show up anyway, or, you know, people are going to do their own thing, but, it was entirely very respectful and understanding. And then further than that, how can we help? You know, people were ready to roll up their sleeves and get to work to support that race director, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's fantastic that people are willing to do that, because I think that there are people who realize that by doing that, they're also ensuring that the event has the ability to move on, you know, yeah. to once again, you know, rise up if it's a wildfire from the ashes, so to speak, and be run the following year.
Y'all know who Turia Pitt is, right?
Say that again.
Turia Pitt. Do you know who Turia Pitt is?
No.
She was in Racing the Planet race maybe like 8 or 9 years ago, 12 years, maybe 12 years ago. I'm old, so everything seems recent. I think 2000's recent. They didn't cancel a race. They didn't shut down a course when there was a wildfire encroaching.
Okay.
She survived, and she survived after skin grafts and being in a burn unit.
Yes.
When they didn't shut down a course.
Yes.
I mean, there are consequences. She is able to function, but like, she nearly died, and that kind of stuff can cause you amputations. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, well, it's just my risk. Like, I think a lot of us who are very good at the sport are very stubborn and very impulsive, or we would not run 100 milers for a fun, like, oh, that's fun, obviously. And I think once in a while, when people do say things, I try to be understanding, but also to speak to those folks, because I think it's really easy to impulsively feel like this indestructible teenager. You know, I can bench 150 pounds. I can go run 100 miles. I've thrown up and not been able to take anything down for like 6 hours in a row, and I still finished that 100. Like, to feel like, bring it, and forget what those consequences are and what those consequences will be like to people around us, to our loved ones. Like, it's very easy. We all have that. What? There's a more horrible race? Where's the sign up page? No, you know, like, we're all like that, or we wouldn't be any good at this sport. We would look at it and we'd go, well, that's dumb. I might get seriously hurt, and we would stop.
Right.
And when we started to hurt in races, we would stop. We wouldn't run our blood sugars down to like 40 and have to be evacuated off of courses, because we would stop when we realized something was amiss.
You know, so we're not reasonable people, is what you're saying.
We're not. And so I think the difficulty in discussing this, and that's where I definitely, there's been a couple times with the race cancellation where I've known I'm not in a reasonable frame of mind, but you know, I'm going on 50 and I've been through therapy. So when people do say things that are impulsively a little ugly, I'll usually not start a public fight, but try to message and be like, hey man, you know, pause and think maybe before you're putting that out there, because right. You know, there's other factors, and I get it. I 100% relate to your emotions. I completely feel you. However, let's consider, which is what I like about this article, is that this article is all about, of course, we have these emotional responses, but let's all pause and remember that we're not the only human on earth. There's people around us, and all this stuff impacts them as well, you know? And absolutely. I don't just mean because the race makes the news in a bad way. I mean, somebody watching you die is going to scar them for life. You'll be dead.
Right.
Your worries will be over. But like, you know, right. We need to all think about. It has a ripple effect.
Or even the people who have to come save your dumbass.
Also that. I mean, sometimes they're just entertained, but they could get hurt depending on the conditions.
Yeah, you strain their resources, or, you know, somebody else really could have used their help, but their resources are exhausted.
Just leave me on the trail and let me die. I can't personally, like, if I encounter even a total stranger, even if I've met them before and I think they're a douche, but they're actually like actively so hypothermic, I know if I leave them, they're going to die.
Yeah, you can't do that.
I'm not that person.
Right.
I'm not. I'm going to grab a hold of them and try to drag them with me. And I'm going to put my spare layers on them and I'm going to drag them. And I'm not going to make the race cutoff either. And I'm going to not get to finish because their dumbass didn't have a layer and I have to drag them to the end. And I've given a layer to a person. I had it spare, but like I've given layers to people. I've given batteries to people. Like we all have. We all have. That's the sport. And I have messed up and forgot a spare set of batteries at aid station before and someone has helped me. Like that's the sport. There's a certain amount of it. But I do think when we start getting so angry that something wasn't allowed to continue, and there's limits, like we should be allowed a certain amount of hazard.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a point where you have to stop being so angry that you're being required to carry this rain jacket or that you can't continue when actually search and rescue will almost certainly have to come get your butt.
Right. And trust that they, you know what they're talking about and have a certain amount of respect, I think, for the outdoors and the mountains too.
Oh, you mean that the people that live up in the mountains and do this for a living might know their shit better than right. me in Cleveland, Ohio, in the cornfields? Yeah, that. Yeah, also that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
On June 2nd of this year, Heather sent out an email formally canceling 2021's Fat Dog 120. It was very sad. It wasn't a particularly long email, as some cancellation emails can be. It was direct and forthcoming, neatly organized by bullet points. In the end, COVID-related uncertainties had driven her decision to cancel. Permitting uncertainties, supply chain uncertainties, provincial uncertainties, volunteer uncertainties, support crew uncertainties. One uncertainty after another had piled up until the pile got too big to ignore. The email is a tough read, if only in the sparse quality of its candor. The government group in charge had no clue how to promote trail races, Heather said. They were really well versed in community sporting events, but they didn't know how to answer our questions. She was left with no choice. And I know
that sums up that email really well.
Yeah. And I know
I remember getting that email.
Well, we were waiting to see if they would let Americans in. And I think at first they were gonna have maybe just Canadians run the race and then we were waiting to see if they would let us in for sporting events. And somehow if we were basketball players, they would have let us, or tennis players, but because we were trail runners, there was no rule for that.
But there was also for a while it looked like there might be a loophole on driving across the border.
Yeah.
As long as
we said we were going to Alaska.
There was some kind of loophole for driving across the border. We're like, well, we've all been thoroughly vaccinated.
Right.
And we could actually, we can arrange housing that's contactless key pickup. We can arrange housing where we don't actually get within 10 feet of anybody Canadian, except during the race. And we can have face coverings on at the start. And plus there are other trail runners at that point. And we're all vaccinated. So we're like figuring out, we're like, well, okay, so.
Heather knows how resourceful our kind are.
Like, we're like, well, we can bring our backpacking stuff and we can get there without endangering.
We hitchhike across the border.
We're vaccinated. So we'll get all that stuff. We'll get tested right before we go. And then we'll bring our backpacking stuff so that if we have trouble with a motel, we can camp. There's camping everywhere there. So we won't risk infecting anyone, you know, in case breakthrough infection. We're like, we've got this.
We tried hard. We were very creative in all of our thinking.
And then they canceled.
Yeah.
Bless.
Lee Connor sat at a long wooden table in the dining hall of the hostel watching cold, soggy stragglers materialize from the storm. Rain beaded off the ridges of their noses and clung like threaded crystals to the frozen tips of their hair. Some of them shook from the transition into warmer temperatures. Others seemed to shake reflexively, entirely unable to control the spasming in their extremities. They all bore stunned expressions. The aid tent that had stood just downhill of the hostel had collapsed and mangled in the wind. Those inside, when it happened, shielded themselves with a mattress as they made their way uphill toward safety. What had been a small gathering of 7 or 8 people when the storm began had swelled to near 40. 6 inches of ice and sleet had accumulated on the ground outside. Search and rescue missions were in full swing at various points along the course. With space at a premium and the prospect of hunkering down likely, people had begun to stake tiny claims wherever there was room available. People lay down on tables, on benches. They propped themselves against walls and wedged themselves into corners. Lee grabbed her gear and laid it out beneath the table. A Spanish runner set his things beside hers. They talked, trying to pass the time, making the best of the cramped conditions. Just then, the hostel door slammed open. Four members of a search and rescue team barreled into a hall carrying a runner. He was unconscious. His complexion was gray, his body stiff. He had been missing in the storm for hours. What had happened was he got under a ledge when the hail started, said Lee. He had gotten cold so fast he never got all his layers on. He had simply gotten soaked, and it was suddenly 30 degrees. He became hypothermic so fast he couldn't think. Without missing a beat, the rescue team rushed the runner throughout the crowded hall and down a hallway to a room in the back of the hostel. Oh, shit, Lee remarked, thinking. He is going to die. Now, you're talking about required gear at the beginning and talking about the required gear for this race. I know, because we're friends, that we do a lot of races that have required gear. Can you talk a little bit, Lee, about maybe Ronda, but also other races? What sort of gear has been required, and what has been the process of them making sure that you have your gear on you?
So at Ronda del Sims and UTMB, which that's European races, when you come, we just do not do this much here. I've been at one or two run bum races that had some gear check.
And that's because he runs over.
He did. European he made you actually, too. Yeah. And he was like, well, actually put the shit in a plastic bag and hold it up a second. And we're going to point at the things when they tell you. The European races, literally like UTMB and Rundell Sims did this. You come into the check-in place in a line and you come to a table and you show them an ID or something to prove who you are. And they give you a tag and the paper has pictures of certain gears on it. And then you go over to another table and you take those gears out of your kit. You don't know what it's going to be in advance. And it's usually three or four things. And you have this big plastic bin, you know, like the airport security bins. And you put the things in it and you put your pack back on and you walk over to the other table and you show them your paper and you show them your other tag and they look at your items and they take each one out, like your rain jacket, and they turn it inside out and they look at all of the seams and they take whatever items you have and they look at them closely. And they better meet the criteria, because if they don't, then you don't pass gear check and they bounce you and you don't get your bib. And you can come back later, because gear check is open for like hours. Like the day before the race, there's like 8 hours of it's open for multiple distances. And you need to have like an elastic bandage and a roll of tape, like a little thing of tape, and 4 or 6 large safety pins and 2 lights, 2 sets of backup batteries. And they'll check to make sure your lights turn on if that's on your list. A cell phone that does work in that country that you can show actually has reception, that you can show actually has the emergency numbers for the countries that the race is in. Your cell phone doesn't function because you're so far up. A lot of times you do have signal. And even when you don't have regular cell phone signal, you do have emergency. A thing I learned at Blood Rock, had no cell reception. My phone pocket dialed 911.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. And then they started yelling at me. But here's the thing. I was completely dazed at 3 a.m. and had fallen, and that's how it hit things.
Oh.
And so I hear this voice coming from the pocket of my race vest. But I was trying to find the next marker and I couldn't see it. I'm like, where are you? And the voice is actually in my pocket. Oh, it was funny as shit. And finally I figured that out. I take it out and it's the 911 operator calling me back, actually, or patching through or something, because my phone had butt dialed or pocket dialed when I fell, because it hit whatever combination it takes to go through lock screen and airplane mode to call anyway. It was in fucking airplane mode. So anyway, you can call. So they make you have all the emergency numbers loaded in there. They check that and they put a tag on your bag. And then there's a mid-race gear check at some races. You come in an aid station, they hold up a thing. You have to show them those items or you are pulled at that point. There's time penalty for certain things, but like if you don't have your seam sealed rain jacket, you're done.
They did that at Bighorn where they you will have your gear at another aid station.
And Bighorn should, because you remember how bad the carnage was at the turnaround? That was insane.
There were grown men crying in the corner with blood streaming down their face saying, please don't make me go back out there.
And I came in and I saw the aid station and I was like, and I got my drop bag and I actually had put dry layers, which I rarely do. And this poor old guy at the table is hooked. I'm like, He's like, I'll find you a chair. I'll find you. I'm like, no, I'm not sitting in the same station. No, I dumped everything. I repacked my best. I set it on the table. I'm like, just stand here. I need dry clothes. Stand. He's like, well, I'll find you. I'm like, no, stand. Can you hold your arm like this and stand there? And I lay out my dry layers on the table of my, cause it was just my upper body dry layers. I was like, screw it. I'm just going to run back down the mountain in shorts as fast as I can. I'm just putting on wool tops. My legs will be frozen. I do not care. I'm not changing socks or shoes. And I stripped completely naked to the waist, wearing those tiny little race shorts with no liner, hung it all on his arm and like started putting on my clean. But before I could get on my dry bra, like he turned his head to figure out why he's holding stuff, realizes that I'm standing there in nothing but like ankle socks and a pair of tiny running shorts. Nothing else. He noticed, turned back away like, oh, he was like 70 something, which isn't that old, but like he was older guy. But then, very gentlemanly about it. Then I put on my other layers and I was like, thanks, man. I got to repack. He's like, I'll repack your drop bag. You have a good race. I just put on my jacket and took off because I was like, I'm not staying here. I'm just not doing it. Like, no.
You had to get out of there as fast as you can.
I stayed at the table by the front door, but literally everyone was so distraught. This is what gets me. There were about 60 people in that room and I was standing in the front entryway, stripped completely to the waist. And nobody noticed except that one guy that had his arm out because I was facing his arm. So at least it wasn't like super obvious, but like it was pretty obvious. Like it wasn't a lot of block. I was just like this. I'm going to change as fast as possible. And if me in my 40s with my A cup is like someone's excitement in life that they got a glance at it, more power to them. Praise Jesus. Because
that is like,
don't care.
That's something to note though. The Jaws aid station at Bighorn is like, I think it's two very large, like military sized tents. And there's got to be at least 50 people in those tents, if not more. And there's so much going on that nobody noticed your breasts, your bare breasts in the middle.
Like, I mean, they're not huge, but you know, yeah, no, like, no,
there's so much going on. You have this really distinct knowing going into there, like you have to leave as fast as you can. However,
but dry.
And I did a similar changing of my clothes, but my boobs did not come out. And I had a mother-daughter team feeding me avocados while I was changing my clothes and saw in the corner crying.
I just ate a crack gel and took off.
I was just like, I gotta go.
Man, if they ever cancel Bighorn for weather, you better believe it's disastrous because I heard that year there were people on the 50 mile that got off the bus and refused to start and got back on the bus. And they didn't cancel for weather that year. And it was what killed me at that race is I think it was like 90 degrees in the canyon like 11 a.m. going up towards Jaws. It was like 90 degrees. And then here we are, Jaws at midnight and 1 a.m. And it's like, you know, 35 and wet.
Yeah.
That is hard to cope with. If it's going to be that the whole time, I dress for that. If it's going to be hot, I dress for that. That is a hard race.
Can you imagine signing up for a 50 mile race? Because Chad, I don't know if are you familiar with Bighorn?
Yeah, I am.
So yeah, that 50 mile race is a point to point that starts at the halfway mark for
it's all downhill. It's easy. It's the easiest race.
Can you imagine coming in? Because because you've got the back.
No, they're the 100
mile. You have the back of the 100 mile people.
Still? No, they're already DNF'd, but they're DNF'd by then. Yeah.
Because I can't imagine waiting around. And
that's a 36 hour cutoff.
Go run this.
We started at 5 a.m. on a 36 hour cutoff, and the 50 mile starts at like 7 the next morning. I'm pretty sure you're DNF'd if you're up there after 18 hours.
Doesn't it start in the dark?
You know,
we'll have to talk to a 50 mile person. Well, I signed up for Bighorn again this year. So we could do a Bighorn show and talk to some of those 50 mile people about what they see when they get started.
Wish I was doing Bighorn again this year.
It'll be nice. Ryan Good's going to be there too. It'll be lots of fun.
When is Bighorn?
Father's Day.
I have no idea when that is.
It's June, middle June.
I'll be recovered and trained up, I guess.
You should come.
I doubt it's still open.
You'll have lots of good stories. No, I bet it's open because there was a weird problem with their website where it said it's closed, but it really wasn't. They just forgot to update the website. So I bet they have spots.
I mean, I don't have anything after Cocodona until like July or August.
You should come. You should totally come.
You should literally see the wheels turning right now.
I assume Coca Donut. No, because I had such a good race at Bighorn. I'm scared to run it again. I'll run it so much slower.
No, you won't. It'll be a great year.
Yes, I will.
And you'll Coca Donut uses different.
Shit, I think I was under 28 energy. Hours. I was like under 28 hours for Bighorn. I'm not going to do that again. I was fit when I did that. I'm trying to get fit again.
You'll be fit.
Okay.
May 22nd, 2021. Morning broke gray and overcast against the jagged sandstone cliffs and barren crest, I don't know, of Gansu province in northwest China. At 9 a.m.
Geology words.
172 runners set off into the Yellow River Stone Forest, competing in a government-sanctioned 100K. Outfitted for mild conditions, with many runners wearing nothing more than a t-shirt and shorts, only a few carried additional gear. As the hours passed, clouds gathered and the wind picked up. Cold air swept in off Mongolia's, is it Tengger Desert?
I think Tengger, yeah.
Thank you. Rain started to fall, then grapple. Gales tore through the valleys and buffeted against sheer rock walls. As the weather intensified, the runners' chances for survival rapidly decreased. By the time the race had been officially canceled, it was too late. The gears were already in motion. When the clouds lifted, 21 runners had died of hypothermia. Judgment came swiftly. Within a month, the Chinese government levied charges against the 27 individuals who had assisted in coordinating the run. Inadequate support, botched rescue efforts, and poor communication were found to have doomed the event. 2 days before the punishments were made public, Li Zuobi, Jintai County's party chief, and one of the individuals charged during the government's investigations stood at the ledge of a roof on top of his high-rise apartment building. Unable to cope with the fallout, he jumped. I don't think people realize how easy it is to get hypothermia.
I don't. Like, I definitely... And here's the other weird thing. Like, you have the kit. Remember I said the one guy... Like at Rondell Sims, there was a guy that was carried in, but he was conscious and he was holding on to people and he was okay, but he had to be rewarmed. Like he wasn't good. And the next guy after that was in a horrible state. Both of them did not have on 100% of their mandatory kit. Right. They hadn't stopped and gotten fully dressed. Mm-hmm. I'm also now against Mylar blankets. If you haven't made it into some kind of poncho,
it's goofy.
It's useless. Like unless you're going to wrap yourself in it and lie down somewhere.
Well, and then you should get a bivy instead.
Right. And then in which case you need a bivy. If you're trying to continue, which most of us are, like if you're using it because you're injured, you need a bivy. And if you're not injured, then you're trying to walk. You can't wrap one of those blankets, as we see from the China race, you can't wrap it around you. I now always turn them into ponchos where I make a head hole. I know you can buy a poncho. Everyone was like, you can buy a poncho. Here's your link for a fucking thing that's like this big that weighs like 8 times as much as my homemade one that no one will carry all of the time. It takes up too much space. It's the sole one size fits all. They're huge. If you just turn your blanket one,
you were talking about, it's genius.
I've used it twice now.
Yeah, it's great.
A cute picture I used Carmel it Oregon with one
Cascades. On. Yeah, I used it Oregon Cascades in the overnight because it's possible I overrace sometimes. And then I misjudged my caffeine intake and my brain likes REM when I'm walking. And I like was in a spot that was too technical to manage that out of it. So like, well, screw it. I'm taking a nap. So I my caffeine gel and I lay down in some pine needles. But I put on my poncho and I put my jacket back on and zipped it up. Because I had I was like shivery cold. So I did that. And when I woke up, I was a comfortable temperature. Despite it's just a vest under your jacket, shit works. It works.
Yep.
Well, because, and also, I mean, it traps in your own body heat. And I think, too, I think that.
But it stays on you. You have to have a right. Like, didn't you read about, I love when I post stuff and people are prove to me that they don't have functional literacy. I post, you wear this under your rain jacket. You must have a hooded rain jacket. You take it off. You put this on. You put your rain jacket on over it because it doesn't seal on the sides. You know, but when you zip up your rain jacket and put your race vest back on, then it's trapped under your jacket on your body. It will not work if you wear it by itself. You need to also have a rain jacket. Also have a hooded rain jacket if you're out in the mountains because otherwise you're dumb. But the hooded rain jacket won't keep you warm by itself sometimes because they leak and you're wet under it and you need some more body heat. So light.
Well, that's now I would like to interject with, I think a lot of runners, or I shouldn't say that, I think people who recreate in the outdoors don't realize the difference between a seam sealed rain jacket and some kind of light windbreaker with DWR on it. And
Yeah, there's a difference.
You need a seam sealed waterproof jacket.
Please. But also, but in the Mylar thing works, but these folks didn't have all their stuff. And that's the thing. When Sean and I did High Lonesome, I remember getting very scared because we're up on Monarch Pass at like 2 a.m. or something. And it wasn't bad, but it was like in the 30s and it had become, the air was wet. It was windy. And it's like, it wasn't raining, but the air was wet. So everything was damp. We'd been going all day. We're at like 12,000 something above sea level, coming from like 12 and a half or something. And like, Sean, who never ever gets cold, got the shivers. And I was like, well, shit. He weighs like 185. I cannot carry him down the mountain. And he got the shivers and he started to get like I said something to him and he wasn't entirely. Have you ever talked to someone and you suddenly realize they're a little mentally off?
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, man. So I was trying to get him focused. And I was like asking him a question. And then he was like, well, wait, why is that? And I can't remember what the exact thing was, but like I realized I was also, my thinking was off. But it took until like I noticed him shiver and I was like, shit, Sean shouldn't be shivering. I know enough to know that's not right. Both of us. So then I was like, we're both not well off. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to sit under this, by this rock, under this edge, and we're going to eat every calorie we have on us. And then we're going to do a couple push-ups to get our body temperature up. And then we're running for the tree line. And we're not stopping till we hit the tree line. I don't care who hurts or how much, or if it overpaces our race. We're not okay. We're not like, I was like, my thinking is sludgy and yours is too. And he's like, his reason for why he wasn't sure if I was right made no sense. And I'm like, dude, has a master's in mechanical engineering and his logic was off and he's like, I think I'm okay. Like, I'm like, you're shivering when I just stop you to hold still. You're not okay. So like both of us forgot we had Mylar blankets. Neither of us ever took them out.
Right.
We're not used to carrying them. The race mandated them, but because we're not used to, and the race can't do anything about this, but because we're not used to carrying them, we both forgot we had them.
Yeah.
Our thinking went sloppy without us noticing it. So we were already off before we realized that we were dangerous cold because we're hiking up and you're moving. Yeah. And Lindsay, we literally never remembered we had them. And we both had packs on where we could have at least, like, you can put one on and put your pack back on you and hold it to your torso with your pack.
Yeah.
You know, although the blanket that comes with the Salomon kit is fucking useless. It's going to completely tear into shreds. That's what everyone had in the China race. I bet you Salomon kit. They've never tested them. When you unfold them out of the bag, they actually just tear apart, even without wind. You have to take your Mylar out and make sure that it can unfold. Some of them stick to themselves when they're old and they are completely useless. So anyway, which I digress, but you have to remember you have it and then it has to actually be something that won't tear when you open it. So those Mylar blankets are not really a good kit requirement. They're a we're covering our ass requirement if you haven't actually unwrapped it and made sure that there's a way to get it on you without it coming apart.
And it doesn't cost a whole
lot.
Then
you got to remember. You got to remember you have it.
To remember you have it. And then also, you know, the circumstances. Yeah, I now touch it.
When the sun goes down, I touch my little, where I have that thing, the poncho.
Yeah.
I touch it, like through my pack. I'm like, I have the poncho.
Make sure you have
it. If I get
it.
Cold, I'm putting poncho on. If I get cold, I'm putting this on. If I get cold, I'm going to put this on. And like, I touch it physically. If I get cold, I put this on. I have my crack gel. It's in this pocket. If I get sleepy, I eat this. If I get cold, I put this on. Like, I have to like rehearse at like 10 at night. Because you started at 5 in the damn morning. Sometimes you've been up since 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
You have to like rehearse that you have it.
Well, and also,
if you don't rehearse,
being
you
low
forget.
On calories due to your decision making processes and your ability to regulate your own body temperature. So, if you are on the side of a mountain, a storm blows in and you're way under caloried also. And I think another thing that people don't realize, and what the average outdoor temperature when somebody gets hypothermia is like 42 degrees. I think that people think it's something for like below zero, but it's not at all. It's usually between 30 and 50.
And wet.
Yeah.
50s and wet will do it. Anything under 55, if you get wet and your calories are low, will do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's news to me. Actually, I had no idea that was the case.
Because you get wet.
So, yeah, that's interesting.
Under freezing will do it, but usually under freezing, you've remembered to put on layers.
Exactly. Yeah. You're better equipped. It's that 30 to 50 mark.
Oh, because you get wet. and the sun,
especially if it comes in suddenly, because you were it was warm, it was daytime, you're running, you're sweaty, and then all of a sudden it gets cold, and it's just like sitting in your car after a winter run where you just start, you know, like now you're cold and wet.
Yeah. And your hands turn white.
You're in trouble.
Won't go up enough in your car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the China story broke, so too did any illusion within the ultra community that it had been somehow existing outside of the purview of major news and media outlets. What news coverage ultra running had received had often felt tertiary.
Yeah.
Like bones thrown to the oddball hounds who liked playing in rarefied air. Ultra stories seemed written as filler pieces, chewing up column space during slow news cycles. And while the coverage garnered was usually positive and upbeat, it also read as safe. Ultra running felt like back pocket material. What the tragedy in Gansu made very apparent, however, was the major news outlet's enthusiasm for an ultra running story with a body count and teeth. What they got in this case was a story with both of those things and legs. So they ran with it. As events out of China unfolded over the ensuing weeks, story after story appeared in major news outlets like the Wall Street Journal, CNN, and the BBC. Questions naturally arose concerning the sport's overall safety. On June 15th, 2021, the New York Times published an article under the heading, "Where Do Ultramarathons Go From Here?" which made the case that the sport had reached a reckoning, that perhaps ultra running was growing too big too fast and corners were being cut. But was that a fair assessment? Is this a reckoning, or is this what happened in China, the unfortunate result of a sport enduring growing pains? "I think it's a reckoning," said Dale Garland. "We viewed it as a chance to ask some very serious questions and do some very serious evaluation of our policies and procedures, especially around safety and things that might happen. Still, realize that anytime you are outside, you are in an environment where you can't control everything." Any question regarding safety eventually comes as a question around mandatory gear lists. Some have argued that had race organizers in China mandated a list of items that runners would have to had to carry with them during the race, then the casualty count may have been lower. In the United States, the debate has taken on political undertones. There are race directors leery of implementing a mandatory gear list because they don't want to be seen as forcing runners to do something they otherwise wouldn't. Instead, they issue suggested gear lists, which require no enforcement at all. However, the argument can be made that having a mandatory gear requirement would decrease the number of ultras being canceled mid-race due to inclement weather. Hard Rock's stance on the requirement remains up in the air. "We've considered it," said Dale. "We haven't pulled the trigger on it." Heather McDonald, however, has pulled the trigger. "We've had it for years," she said, referring to Fat Dog's gear list. "We check people before the race, making sure they have everything they need." She goes on to recount an experience she had in 2015. "We had a horrendous storm. Before the race, it looked wonderful. You never would have believed there was going to be a problem. Some of the racers were asking why they had to carry all this stuff. At the end of the race, they had all thanked us." That dog's gear list is not unreasonable. It requires things like extra food, headlamps, mid-layer clothing, and a waterproof jacket, among other items. Most of the gear will have likely been carried by runners regardless. In an emergency situation, gear affords you time. It affords you a puncher's chance. Still, the difference between a mandate and a suggestion could be the difference between a canceled race and a race seen through to the end. When the storm hit in 2015, Heather nearly called off the event while runners were still on the course. She didn't, however, for two reasons. The runners had the tools to prolong survival if necessary, and she had an emergency response plan. The race in China lacked both. "You have to have a way to get people off the course," said Heather. "You have to have your emergency response plan in place. You have to do all of that before you ever let people go." So one of the things outside of that, and this has nothing to do with 100-mile mountain races or 100K mountain races, but recently there was a unevent, like non-emergency level horrible debacle in running news as the Boise Marathon. Some people heard about it, but basically the Boise Marathon, which is a Boston qualifying race, it was rainy during the race, not a storm. I wouldn't call it storm, but it rained. And the aid stations were completely abandoned along the course. There were no course markings. There was one port-a-john. The people who were signed up for the 5K ended up getting lost and running 10 miles. It was just a horrible, giant shit show that made like national news. It was terrible. And one of my first reactions to this was, who gave these people a permit? And that's part of it too, because, you know, there's very responsible race directors, but depending on where you're trying to have a race and the governing body, whether it's a park system or something like that, in order to get a permit, you have to prove that you've done your due diligence to have like search and rescue on hand, to have an emergency response plan for getting people off course if something bad happens. Some of those gear requirements may be intact. And I've even heard of the race times. There's a race me and Lee did out in Utah that started at like 2 a.m. or something just stupid. And one of the questions was like, why in the hell are we starting this race at 2 a.m.? And the answer was to make sure you're off that mountain before that afternoon storm comes. For safety.
Do you want to know what? We were still in frickin' Castle Valley in the middle of the heat of the day, which was also special.
Yes.
If it's the race I'm thinking of, yeah. Then we got to come through down through Castle Valley and say, like, oh, well, now we're in direct sun and it's like 102. I'm sure glad I didn't get hit by that afternoon storm.
Right? But I mean, you know, it's got to be... I don't know how much of this, Chad, you saw or looked into or anything like that, but there's got to be some, because most races need a permit. I mean, what kind of questions are being asked by the governing body issuing these permits? Or, I mean, that comes to mind with, you know, how are you allowed to have a mountain race and not be asked about an emergency plan?
Yeah,
usually you are. Most people I know who race direct those have been asked within the U.S. and Europe and Canada. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not sure other places I've raced. I know most places I've raced, there's definitely contingency plans. Like there's a, like you see the emergency medical people.
Mm-hmm. Like I didn't delve too deeply into that specific question. I did look into some of the insurance stuff that goes with race planning. So the American Trail Running Association works with a firm that deals exclusively with insuring a lot of the events that go on across the country. And I was curious to see how that impacted race directing. And the reality is that for a great deal of these events, the race director has to provide the information that you're talking about in order to be insured. Which is reassuring, but this particular, you know, firm, for example, only deals with so many races, and this sport is just growing exponentially. So you are dealing with a lot of brand new race directors who are putting on events where the permitting is going through very small, municipalities or groups that aren't used to throwing these events, and so you know you're leaving yourself susceptible as a sport to to accidents, to stories like what happened in China.
The thing about everyone being like, oh, it's a wake up call. Chinese trail running is not culturally really linked. A handful of Chinese nationals run here, and I understand that a handful of us have run, I haven't, but like Galagong, but that's a UTMB race. It is not culturally Chinese, it is culturally European. This is being put on by UTMB. Other than Mount Galagong, I know extremely few people who have raced in China.
What I found with
and
the
no
China
one
thing
has
specifically,
got a link with that culture, so it was just weird to me to see the New York Times like, "Oh, it's a wake up call for the sport." Mm-hmm. That's like being like, it's a wake up call for the rest of the world because Russia is doping their athletes. Like,
right.
No, it's not. So it's that funny, country's cause... program. I mean, maybe we're all doing it. I'm not saying that we aren't all. I'm just saying it's right. That was a BS slow news week kind of nonsense when
totally
our media
agree.
Here was like, oh, wake up call for the sport. No, man. Yep. Learn something more about the sport before you write an article.
I see, and I completely agree. And so that's when I wrote that passage, I was amazed because when I looked into the China thing, all of a sudden I'm getting links to articles by, like I said, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not talking just a story. I'm talking like five, six.
Oh yeah. Believe my non-running and family member friends.
And so all of a sudden we have these entities, these outlets that never pay attention to our sport, who feel like it's their prerogative to suddenly chime in. And so when you get an article, and I don't know if I was mentioned this to you specifically, Lee, when we were talking, but when you get an article that asks a question like, is this a reckoning? And it's coming from the New York Times.
Everybody gets their trail news from the New York Times.
Yeah, but anybody who reads that outside the sport is going to have a completely skewed idea of exactly what's going on within
sport. That's unshocking. That's mainstream media.
It is unshocking. But when I was asking questions about it, I was surprised by those who didn't think it was a reckoning, so to speak, and those who did. Like, you know, like obviously Dale said he felt like it was, but I spoke to others.
Because Gale has no required gear. And he saw that. Can happen. Most of the people who make it to Hard Rock in the U.S., most international runners are familiar with regular gear requirements and just have their regular gear they'd have.
And see, and
most
I, when
their
I spoke
qualifying
with,
races
with Heather
have
about that, when I, she did not, she was, she did not feel like that this was a reckoning, you know? And I think that you do see that. You see those who have been implementing these mandatory gear lists for a long period of time, who kind of maybe I think saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah, they should have done that.
Yes.
At least have a jacket, man.
Yeah.
Have a rain jacket.
Yeah. And then, you know, then you see those on the other side of that who don't have it. And, you know, maybe they are rethinking this thing. Maybe, you know, but one of the other things that jumped out at me when I wrote this was that one of the race directors that I spoke with mentioned that this difference between a mandate and a suggested list. And for some reason that just jumped out at me as a red flag, because if you are going to
a red flag that he watches OAN.
What's that? You know what?
A red flag that he watches OAN.
In my opinion. Yes.
You know what?
Exactly.
You're also free not to sign up for the race. You're free to go in the mountains by yourself
and you
not tell anyone
you
went up there. You have signed up for a race with other people. If you don't want to be part of a cooperative effort that has rules, do not sign up for a race where you pin a bib to yourself and read. Races actually have rules. They all do. Like, you're not allowed to litter. There's rules for the race, and you don't have to. You don't have some right to run every race on earth. Boston Marathon makes you meet a qualifying standard. If your ass is too slow, you don't get to run Boston. If you're too poor, you don't get to run New York unless you're stupid fast. Like, it turns out you can't drive an $80,000 luxury car if you make $30,000 a year, unless you steal it and then you might go to jail. Like, our world does not actually give you access to everything at all times.
And see, and I agree with you completely. And I've actually, for whatever reason, ever since you and I have had that conversation and I've had this conversation with others, I've been thinking about it. And I've been kind of doing some of my own writing just to figure this out separately. And I completely agree with you. I think when you start introducing this notion of a suggested gear list into an event, to me, it means that you think in your mind there should be a mandatory list, but you're afraid to pull the trigger. And that bothers me, because I think that if you in your mind believe that there should be a mandatory list out there, then you need to put it out there. You need to create that list. You need to put the safety of the runners, you know, at the forefront of your mind, and you just need to do this. If you're afraid of offending a few for the greater good, I'm sorry, but then maybe
you should be in charge.
You should have the courage and conviction.
It bothers me that the whole notion of a suggested list bothers me, because I think that we are bowing to the wrong message. And I'm not saying this is endemic. I don't think that this is something that is all race directors are dealing with. I think most of them are pretty cut and dry, but just the simple fact that a few of them might be raises some concern, in my opinion.
Yeah, same. I'm sure some of it's cultural, but come on now.
Yep,
I think that what this article really brought to my mind, and, you know, talking about the reckoning and things like that, is more on, and the sport is growing exponentially. And I feel like it's the runner's responsibility to do research about the race itself. Find out, like, is this a first year race? Have they had this race for many years? Who is the race director? You know, like, what kind of reputation do they have for putting on events? Is this their first event ever? Like, is this somebody that you would trust to guide you through the mountains? And, you know, like, because there has been some situations where, and in some of those municipalities where, you know, this suggested gear kind of culture comes from, where, like, you know, just anybody can have a race in some places. Apparently anybody can have a marathon at Boise. Like, just anybody can. So, you know, with that understanding, do some research about the event you're doing, and, you know, learn about who's putting it on. And is this their first day? And if it is, then go in with that knowledge. You know, if you're confident in your own skills and you bring your own things and you're awfully resourceful and you study the country that you're about to go into, yeah, do the first year race. But also know if, you know, this person isn't even a runner themselves and they don't even live in the area where they're throwing the race.
So,
Doing it for a profit as a business, and you're putting yourself in a dangerous spot by entrusting them in rugged mountain country when they don't even go out there and they haven't even done the course themselves.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it was Lee, actually, when you and I were speaking, you made a mention of the fact that, you know, you are looking at these races and researching these races. Go ahead and look into the the Ultra sign up and see if you can find some of the information on the race director. See if they've run a 100-mile run, and because they need to know. They need to know what they're asking their participants to take part in. And I do think that's important. And I'm not, you know, to kind of just double back a little bit, I'm not saying that all races need to have a mandatory list, because there is just simply some that just don't. You know, there really are.
Yeah, Hurt 100, no one has ever gotten hypothermia. Yeah.
There's just some races that don't need it. But if you are in a position as a race director where the thought has crossed your mind and you've entertained the notion of a mandatory gear list, then that is something that needs to be taken seriously. And I think you just need to come down on one side of the line or the other. I just don't think there's any middle ground in that, personally.
Absolutely. Yeah. At some point, they said the race was shut down, recalled Lee. Like, beneath the table, the close quarters made for strange music. Lee listened to disembodied conversation quietly drift about the room in whispered French, Spanish, and Catalan. Sometimes the conversations were in broken English. There were coughs, heavy sighs, and snoring. There was the rumble of empty stomachs, the shuffle of wet clothing, and the low moan of the hostel being battered by the elements. It was anxious, restless music. Sleep was elusive. Early the following morning, word spread of an evacuation. The weather had moved on overnight and the roads were beginning to reopen. The hall began to vibrate. Runners took knuckles to their thighs and calves, working out knots and stretching. They put on their damp shoes and double-checked their gear, making sure everything was secure and accounted for. Aid station volunteers and rescue personnel did much the same. Lee gathered what was hers and waited to leave. The evacuation was slow, if uneventful. Those stranded overnight had to make their way along an icy section of trail to a road 5 miles away. Their numbers stretched out along the trail like a shell-shocked caravan. When they arrived at the road, buses waited to take them off the mountain. And just like that, it was all over. Listening to Lee recount her experience at Ronda del Sims, one thing becomes abundantly clear. She calls it how she sees it. You can't bullshit Lee. She takes a highly intellectualized approach to ultra running. Her stories are often delivered like her opinions, with force and intent. She speaks articulately, with depth and confidence. If she misses a detail, don't worry, she'll double back eventually and fill it in. All without ever losing her momentum. Ask her opinion on mandatory gear requirements. I am all for gear requirements. If you don't like gear requirements, don't sign up for races that have them. China. I have seen races that have no gear requirements. I did not go into the mountains in a t-shirt without gear. To do that, you must be out of your mind. Or accountability. If you are trying to take yourself into the mountains and you have done no research and no reading, you are being irresponsible. And I have no sympathy. Ask another runner. For heaven's sake, you can find someone else who runs trail ultras. And you know what we like to talk about? Trail and ultra running. And you may find her responses difficult to stomach, but invariably you will have to ask yourself, is she wrong?
See, now I'm all like,
I know, that's how you sweet talk Lee right there. She's all blushing, smiling.
That was like the one part of this that when I found out we were doing this together, I wasn't quite sure how she was going to react. I was like, how is this going to go?
I do like talk. That's true though. Like really, I don't want to bother the other ultra runners by asking them an ultra running question. Are you for serious? Let me tell you what all the ultra runners want to talk about that no one but you wants to hear about. The ultra running. Yes, we do.
And that leads into like mentorship is such an important part of our sport. And exactly, like find somebody who knows what they're doing, go on a run with them. I know I can go on a run with Lee and ask her like literally one question. And then like, she'll just tell like.
An hour later, like long runs have done.
That's funny because when we were discussing, when we were having our conversation, I had questions, but I realized that during the course of the conversation that what was developing, like the story that she was talking about and the way that she was telling the story, like I didn't need to really ask a lot of questions because I was getting everything I needed, like legitimately everything I needed. When I listened back later to our discussion, I realized that pretty early on, I kind of just felt really quiet. Like, and I just let her talk because it was all there. It was very, you know, it was linear. It was thorough, but like I was getting all the information I needed and you can, and like that was, it's, I don't know. It was frankly, it was refreshing. It was good to kind of have that situation just to kind of sit back and absorb, because I actually walked away from that, with really an entirely new perspective on where not only the article was going, but just on what my thoughts were as an ultra runner. And so it was great. It was awesome. It was a lot of fun.
Well, and with that, it makes, with Lee or with anybody else, it makes their experience a shared experience when you go over it like that. And totally. I think it's helpful. It's helpful for, you know, to tell your story about what you learned and what you didn't and what you like and what worked and what didn't work, because all of our lessons that we have that are running lessons can become that like of our friends and our running family and things like that. I think we can learn from one another.
I would hope so. Yeah. I mean, I know that there are things that we discussed that never made it into this article and that we probably won't touch on tonight that I know I will take into my next race. I just know I will, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, the witching hour at night, just kind of my approach to it and just hearing some of the suggestions she made and the advice, like I just know I'm going to use it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you're right. That's what I think we tend to take from each other is you know, hopefully it's not just the story, but hopefully it's the detail that goes into the story. The little bits of advice that kind of litter any sort of narrative that we tell when we're sitting around talking, those are the things that I think are, they're great. Those are fun things.
Not all cancellation stories are heavy. Not all of them highlight bureaucratic failure. Sorry, my words are not working. Wildfires and death. Some carry compassion and generosity. Gentle reminders of the good people that good people are capable of doing when things go bad. In 2020, COVID effectively canceled racing. Some ultras switched to a virtual format. Others simply carried out over registration to 2021. The Hellbender 100 did neither. Regarding registration, we are offering a 100% refund, read the email race director Aaron Saft sent to runners, informing them of the event's cancellation. What you saw in that email was based off of my opinion of what I felt was fair to the runners, said Aaron, especially given that we were going through what we were going through with COVID. In a sport tethered to rising costs, issues regarding money can be difficult to navigate. Shoes are expensive, gear is expensive, travel is expensive. Race registration prices are growing exorbitantly, in some cases as high as $1,500 a race. Yet, even as runners continue to fill registration rosters, there are quiet murmurs of dissatisfaction regarding the refund policies those very same races offer. In most cases, the refund policy is simple. There is no refund. Some races may offer refunds based on proximity. The closer to race day, the smaller the refund. Either way, these policies are not in place to swindle anyone. There is simply the reflection of an industry whereby nearly everything is paid for upfront, which makes Aaron's decision all the more remarkable. What I did is not typical, said Aaron, but I am a believer that if an event doesn't provide anything to the runners, it's not right to hold their money for which they didn't get anything in return.
Didn't he let us leave a portion of it for donation, though? If we want to.
Yes, I was going to say, I got like
that I wavered the refund or part of the refund on that.
I think he goes on. I have a couple more sentences here and then we'll talk about it. What it did is not typical, said Aaron. Oh, yeah. This just might be the wildest cancellation story of all, Chad writes. I wear my heart on my sleeve, added Aaron. I really believe in the goodness of people and I want to do what's right for our community. Amen, brother. I think we're both signed up for Hellbender that year that it got canceled. Yep. I know I received Aaron Saf's email and what it said was,
I've never not signed up for Hellbender.
Right. Did you sign up for Hellbender again?
Oh, because Cocodone, I'm so upset. He moved the date by like 3 weeks and I can't do both.
Oh, I'm aid station captaining Cocodona and I'm running Hellbender.
Well, I'll see you then.
I'll see you there. I'll be in Jerome. But Aaron Saf sent this email that the race was being canceled, Hellbender, and that basically the race registration, I don't remember how much the race registration was. Let's say it was $275. I don't know. And then he said, you know, I probably spent about $40 in my expenses so far per runner. I spent about $40. And he said, so what we can do is we can, if you are so kind, I'll refund you minus the $40 that we've already spent. He said, if you need the money, I'll give you a full refund, no questions asked. I don't think that he had an option to go on and defer your entry because he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to have the race again.
No, he really wasn't. The race actually was temporarily never going to be happening again. And yeah. I don't know how he got the help or the wherewithal. But like the small shoe company he works for in the state he's in,
he lost his business.
Allow him to do door-to-door deliveries. They weren't allowing that. He's in a state that pretty much put small businesses out of business during COVID while letting big businesses do delivery.
Yeah.
And so although he could have kept his shoe store running, the state shut him down, basically. They just favored big business over small business. And because that's part of how he runs things, that put him in a bit of a jam regarding what he was going to do for living.
Yeah, from my understanding, Chad, and to the listeners, is that exactly like Lee's saying, you know, in some of our communities, when COVID happened, running stores had like curbside pickup, or yeah, they did delivery, or you can make an appointment and you could like meet with somebody outside and get help. But in the state that he operated in, it was essential workers only outside, and they did not deem his business essential. So at the same time he was canceling this race and offering people a full refund, he lost his business.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He's an amazing person.
I love him.
Outstanding, amazing person. I didn't get off the Hard Rock wait list, but I went out there because I was so close. I was the last person not to come off, but I got to see him finish though. So that was pretty cool.
That is awesome. That is awesome. I'm really excited to be running Hellbender this year. And just to, I don't know, like, I just I'm glad you got to talk to him, Chad, because he definitely is a class act, for sure. And
he is. And he was the first person actually I spoke with when I started this whole process. And he is a class act. And Lee was kind of touching on it earlier. I mean, he was all he asked, you know, he was willing to refund, you know, these entry fees and stuff like that. But he was, you know, saying if anybody can donate, you know, I mean, and just, you know, please, you know, please feel free. You know, I just think that also kind of speaks to the two-way nature of like ultra running community is that, you know, I mean, he's willing to do this, to offer the refund. And, you know, and I think he also understands that, you know, the people he's willing to help and that I and he realizes that, you know, the people on the other side of the equation are willing to help as well. And I think that was what I thought was really, you know, really cool about what he did, was that it worked both ways. And super nice guy. You know, he was. You know, he lives in an area of the country I'm very familiar with, having, you know, lived nearby. And he kind of typifies all that is good in that area. And it was a pleasure. One of these days, it's on my list now. I would love to do the race. So, you know, hopefully in the foreseeable future, I'll be down there. But yeah, it was a treat.
Well, and I think, you know, that kind of brings it all together where, you know, we're talking about these canceled races, we're talking about these events, the race directors, the runners, everything like that. It's a community. And part of what makes it so special is, and why we have these things is because Aaron's a runner too. Like, you know, as most RDs are, they were so inspired and love this sport so much that they wanted to create an experience for others. And it's an immense amount of work, and most of them don't make any money off of it. Most race directors barely break even, or maybe they get enough little extra to buy some beer or something. But I don't know any rich race directors, or at least not ones that are friends of mine. And you know, it's I think it's something to remember when you've got, you're signing up for a race, you know, once again, like, you know, look at their ultra sign up or whatever like that. But I mean, they're a huge part of this community, and a lot goes into putting on these events, the coordination of it, the amount of volunteers that it takes, all the trail work that goes into it. Some trails wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for the race that comes by each year to do that maintenance and things like that. I don't know, like I can go on. Like, this is part of what I love about our sport is just that, you know, all that's contributed to pull off things like this. And then lastly, and for those left wondering, Lee did double back to reveal the fate of the unresponsive runner brought into the hostel. They were able to walk him out the following afternoon. She said he survived. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we really didn't think he would. Tell you what, though, everyone stopped complaining about being disallowed from leaving. The second to last guy that came in that was really not well, like that guy, by then we'd all calmed down. But like, there was definitely some people in the hospital like, come on, you guys got to let us continue. We have our gear.
Yeah.
The race. And then the guy came in that was like being held over people's shoulders and not right. And everyone got real calm. And then they're like, you guys can't leave because all of search and rescue is occupied. We don't have any other helicopters. We have missing people on the course. One of them is somewhere before this aid station. Given the temperatures, if we don't find him soon, we don't think we'll find him alive. And so, no, we have every possible resource on course right now looking for missing people. You may not leave. We cannot have more missing people. We're like, there's another guy out there, because the guy that just came in was not okay. Like, a bunch right. of us had like gotten him dry. Like, we had him up against a heater, but he was still up in front. But like, he was not good. But like, we're like giving him hot soup and like putting every extra layer any of us had, because we only all had our race kit, right? Like, there wasn't much extra, but yeah. There was one heater in the room, so we got him next to that and just everyone put any extra they had on him, and he got okay. Like, he got with it again, but like, we're like, there's someone out there still? Well, shit. You know, like, you're like, wow, okay, that's not good. Because by then it was just heavy hail, and by then the regular race tent had collapsed under the hail. and the two guys that had fallen asleep in it had come up the hill on the little trail to the backpack hut, holding a cot over their heads because of the hail. So like, this was all after. So like, by then we're all like, okay, maybe there's a reason we can't continue. There's
good reason. Maybe they had a good point. In those situations, Lee, and I know you've gotten terribly cold at some races, and obviously, you know, talking about Ronda and others that you've been in, what do you do to bring yourself back from hypothermia or near hypothermia when you, like, what advice or what have you seen or what works, or do you have anything to say on that?
Have layers and spare calories. Get hydrated before it gets cold. Like, that's why it gets so bad at the Bears, because if you have low blood volume because you're dehydrated, you can't regulate body temperature. Like, you're going to get hypothermic at a much, much higher temperature if you're dehydrated. It's just how the body works. You also overheat worse, but you also get hypothermia. You can't stay warm if you don't have enough water inside of you. Pee in your bladder does not count. That makes you colder. Like, you have to have enough blood volume to warm your body. If you're dehydrated, you can't stay warm. So, you know, hydrate and put in all the calories. Eat a bunch of sugar. See if you don't get warmer. But I mean, mostly have your layers, you know, have a plan. And then hope. Keep going. I don't know. That's amazing.
So Chad, what's next for you? I guess, to sum it up, like, where will you find yourself? What are you training for? Where will your adventures take you? What are you up to?
So this is my off season when it comes to races, or even really, I mean, I'll still run throughout the winter, but with work, my obligations are to work. If it snows, I have to be ready to plow. So, my schedule is pretty much as open as the weather allows. So I'll probably start ramping back up in late March, April. Specifically, I don't know what I'm going to, be running next year yet. I do know I'm going to be doing some more writing between now and then, which I'm excited about. It'll be something to definitely get through the winter. Beyond that, I'm just kind of playing it by ear. I'll probably start looking into things in June, probably January or February.
Wonderful. And we're excited to have you write more pieces, hopefully, for
Easy 30,
because this was fantastic.
I appreciate it. I would love to write more pieces.
Wonderful. Lee Connor, what are you up to these days, and how are you spending your time? What are your upcoming adventures? What can you tell us?
Marcus Island. Let's see. So I'm actually recovering from, I ran a 50 miler.
You did Mount Massacast.
I did.
And it was a new course, wasn't it?
It was.
How did it go? Tell us.
Super more fun than the old course. Super more fun.
Really?
Because the early easy sections are gone. It's just all more hilly trail. So that's super fun. I'm like doing a lot of exercises. And then Carmel, my girlfriend, is doing a video project where she's got some local people, some women who are trying to run their first 100 miler by like fall. Although a couple of them are, I think, possibly aiming less. One of them is just trying to run. There's a new alternative. But so they're all kind of newish. And they're all trying to run their first 50 miler. And so we've got that project going on, and then I'm coaching them. So I get to make them do exercises and running. It's super fun.
How many runners do you have
there's
you're working with?
There's five of them in the video project. But then there's also a private Facebook that is anyone that wants to follow along. And so all the workouts post there, along with links for video of all the exercises, so that you can do all of the strength training, and you can do the whole running schedule if you want to, from wherever you are, if you too are trying to run first 100 mile and are like, shit. What do I do? I'm a woman and I want to, but, So it's a project of, because everyone's like, there's no women at the 100 milers. What do we do? You know what you do is you make a project where you give them exercises and training for free, and you go, this is what we're doing. Everyone's doing it. And then you video some regular people doing it. So Carmel is a genius of video editing and doing all that stuff. I'm just make them have exercises. So much hip strength, but also like there's a running program. But right now we're really early. So right now, like long run, short, some of them are ahead of others, and we're seeing where everyone gets to. But so it's basically she's actually doing massive video editing and has GoPros and like knows how to do that stuff to try to actually follow people's progress. Because I think a lot of it probably crosses gender lines, but it's more prominent with women. And also we are women that are, who are like, I just don't think I could do it. And you look at some of the women that do succeed, and it's like, yeah, you could do it. You just have to decide you can.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people who can't. There's people who have time limitations. There's people who have physical limitations. But there's far more people, and especially with women, who just don't know how to take that jump without a little bit of extra encouragement. And that's all it takes, a little encouragement, a little bit of knowledge. There are more women who did not grow up playing sports, or if they did grow up playing sports, dropped them at college age or dropped them immediately after college and did not play rec sports and just haven't in 15 years. And when you have that gap, there's different strength things you need to do, or you're just going to be injured, or just didn't grow up doing a lot of sports. We've got someone who never grew up playing sports significantly and did couch to 50K in 9 or 10 months flat and has not died or gotten injured and is now trying to get faster. And then we've got one who's not even really a runner, she's a cyclist, but then has dropped that and hasn't been doing much. She's like, you know what? I'm going to become a trail runner. It's very exciting. She's very new. We've got just this mix of people. So we'll see how that goes. But I mean, encourage the other women to run the hundreds and actually provide real, tangible help. Or, you know, I don't feel that I should then be bitching there aren't women at them if I don't help them go do it.
Right.
You know?
And for those listening, Lee, that are interested, what is the name of this Facebook group that you all have put together?
It is the Women's 100 Mile Project. But it is, and it is for beginners. There, I will at some point post to the, there's a ladies running 100 milers and there's the ladies tar. I can post links to YouTube that are shareable, or I can just give them to you because we made a YouTube channel of all the exercises. So for people of any and all genders and experience levels that are just like, I wonder what Lee does for strength training. Here's Lee's dumb strength exercises. And it's me in my living room explaining them and doing them. It's super funny. I will send you the link just so that you can watch me do dumb
please,
things.
Please.
It's, don't blame me if it hurts later. People are like, I could do a zillion crunches. I did this core thing for like less than a minute and now I hurt. Efficient. So we're doing that. We're doing that, trying to encourage a lot of women to, you know, give it a try. And whether they all finish 100 mile or not, they're at least going to go out there and try and have new tools and talk to other people and, you know, believe that it's a triable thing. So that's pretty cool.
That is really cool. And I think too, it is an incredibly approachable and supportive environment that you have cultivated in that group too. It's really neat seeing women supporting other women doing hard things and not seeing each other as competition. Like people feel okay asking questions.
Ladies running 100 milers is close to that too, but it has a lot more experienced people. Mm-hmm. So you get like more of a mix of opinions and not, if you're like, oh, what should I do to train? You've got a bunch of random suggestions. This 100 mile project, the Women's 100 Mile Project is more, there is no other coaches in it.
Right.
It is monomaniacally mine. Here is your plan. I think people are allowed to talk amongst themselves. You can be like, oh, I also do this. That's cool. But like, here's the training plan that's being followed. Ask questions if you like, but this is what we're doing. This is what our group is doing. Follow along or don't. Ladies Running 100 Milers is very much open forum support discussion. It is super supportive, but it's, you go on there and go, oh, well, strength. And you get like 12 opinions of different plans of everything, which for a new person can sometimes be a little overwhelming. I think both things need to exist. But for some of the new folks, they've said, well, I can go on there and ask, but like, I don't even know which thing to believe. And it's all these different things. And it's not one thing to follow. And I don't know what to pick and choose. And if I do them all, I can't even do them. That's like 8 hours in a week. And I only have like an hour for strength training. And so this is just a much more organized and
right,
focused kind of a group.
Is there now with your Women's 100 Mile Project, is there a specific group of races that your group is looking to participate in? Do you already have those races picked out? Or if somebody is a race director listening to this and they have a really well, you know, stocked, I when I think of a good first timer 100 mile race, I think of something with lots of ample aid stations and easy crew access, yeah, and things like that.
Well, a lot of our group is aiming at fall. Now, yeah, there are some people on the Facebook who have sooner races because they're in a different spot because they just are. But most of our immediate group is aiming at a fall race somewhere east of the Mississippi because the immediate group is based out of Cleveland to Akron area. And a lot of them need to not fly or prefer not to, just time off work and expenses. And then most of them have a distinct preference for trail and not 24-hour race. So an actual 100.
Yeah.
So there's a short list of things between September and December, east of the Mississippi, not too far south. Like, so we've got like starting at Run Woodstock, although some of them I think are thinking about the 100K as a test. Mm-hmm. And then we're looking at things like, and there's a list, not just, you know, but like No Business 100, Ozark Trail 100, Oil Creek 100. We're looking at some of the cutoffs, although as you and I both know, a longer cutoff does not always mean better. Ozark right. Trail's 36 hours for the difficulty. It's fairly generous. No Business, I think this year's direction is 33. The race could be deceptively hard, but still. So most of them are things that are giving more than 30 hours and are not flat. I know there's Yeti, but that's rail to trail. Most of these folks are looking for, we'll see if anyone considers
true
that
trail.
One. Yeah. But most of them are looking for trail and a little bit of, you know, hiking and climbing, because they're not looking to go run a PR. They're right. looking for, so things like that. See, there were a couple others on the list, but Oil Creek, Ozark Trail, Uwari, No Business, things that are not insane hilly, Oil Creek. That's the general. I know there's a few others on the list. I can't remember all off the top of my head. I'm sorry to whichever person I forgot. But so there's, you know, there's a short list of things that just kind of happen in that October, November window.
Mm-hmm.
That originally we were thinking Cloud Splitter, and somebody may still brave that because it's got a 40-hour cutoff, but I don't know if you're familiar with their new course. There are 50 damn creek crossings. Good job. Having run it quite recently, granted, I could have not run No Business 2 weeks before, but still, that course will beat you up. But it does give you a lot of time. It gives you 40 hours. And then there's an outlier like Blood Rock,
yeah,
which is clear down Alabama, so you got to fly or drive real far, but it's 48 hours. You can hike that sucker out if you want to. I mean, it's 25,000 feet of gain. There's some medium technical, but if you just keep walking, you will get there. So there's, you know, there's some back and forth about that. Grindstone's a full race. That's 38 hours. It's a lot of climb, but it's not horrific. It's not technical. So right now they're all at the stage of, hey, look at what are the course records? Were these course records set by people who are real, real fast? Look at the top 10 finish times usually compared to what the cutoff is. Like what? Where did the 10th place woman finish compared to what the cutoff is? If the 10th place woman is finishing right against cutoffs, unless it's a very small race, consider that maybe that's a small gap. Like Herd 100, you'll see like the 8th place woman finishing in 33 hours sometimes when the race only gives you 36 hours.
Right.
You know what I mean? Oh, buddy. Like that's tight. You know, Grindstone, you'll see 8th place finishing in, you know, 27 or 8 hours, 29 hours, and the race is giving you 38 hours. So that's a bigger gap there. So we're discussing like how to evaluate things and trying to get everyone to really understand. It's just be like, you're doing this.
What to look for in a race. Yeah.
What to look for. So we're talking about them because when it's 10 to 12 months out, and then some people are thinking about actually 23 for their race.
Yeah.
So you've got things like the Outlaw 100. Because yeah. There are some folks on the online that are out in Oklahoma. Outlaw 100 is also 48 hours. It's surprisingly difficult in places if it does not get the weather that it got this year, which was a low of 5 degrees and a high of 17 and a lot of snow, which typically it does not. Typically it's between 35 and 55. That was a shocker for me.
Yeah.
I did not die. I didn't even lose any toes. 5 degrees cold at night. But it's a long cutoff. So we're discussing what cutoffs mean and everything. Aid stations, frequencies. Whether so or not you want to win that pace.
If you're a race director and any of this sounds like a race that you put on and you want to contribute to the Women's 100 Mile Project by maybe offering an entry to somebody in the group, please reach out to the show.
Yeah,
and we'll put you in touch with Lee.
Yeah, for sure.
That's wonderful.
For sure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and kind of testing out this format of audiobook / immersive conversation around an article for Eat Clean Run Dirty magazine. I think it was a lot of fun. And I just
it was. Thank you. Yeah.
Now we just got to see what other people think of it.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We don't know. It might be garbage, but either way, I've really enjoyed it.
I mean, yeah, I didn't see it. Thank you. You know, it goes back to that Howard Stern show thing. Average listener listened who loved Howard Stern, listened for like one amount of time that was like 50 minutes or 60 minutes. Average Howard Stern hater listened for an extra 20 minutes.
Really?
Said the same. Yes. The people that loved him, they were like, why do you keep listening? See what he'll say next. The people who hated him, but listened longer. Oh, I want to see what he'll say next. look at that demographic. People who just want to see what we'll say next.
Well, that's awesome. Drove people crazy with how I have poor reading skills today. I don't know.
I mean, that was pretty good. He put some big words in there, you know?
He did put some big words in there.
I know.
He's got a vocabulary.
That's just how I write. Yeah. It's just...
Don't apologize. That's good writing.
No, I'm not. It's just how it comes out. I can't. I'm not apologizing. It's just how it flows.
It's excellent.
Thanks. Yeah, appreciate that.
It was well done.
Thank you.
When I read your article, I saw like some of the words that you put in there, and I imagined my friend Lee saying them as you like wrote them. I think that
good. I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
You know, for you to do that, where you like kind of brought people to life through your words, I think that's a pretty good success.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And this only makes me, you know, this makes me even more curious about these, you know, hard races. And then too, I guess, in lasting to some dumb stuff that I do sometimes is we go to these races that are really difficult or whatever in this hard country, and we carry all this required gear. But then when I go to do a long run in a similar country by myself, I don't bring a damn thing. And so this is a reminder of, like, if you're going to go on a long run in the Tetons or whatever by yourself, or in the Sawtooth Mountains, or, you know, out in the Cascades, you know, like I've been able to do since I moved out west, bring a damn Mylar blanket, even though nobody's telling you to, and bring enough calories and bring
jacket,
shit.
Jacket and a little poncho.
Yeah. Especially if you're running alone, like bring a way to communicate too. Don't be a dumbass just because nobody's telling you to bring this stuff. Mm. Do research, you know, and bring stuff to keep yourself safe and possibly people you might find along the way. All right, cool. Well, thank you.